for the invitation. I hope I can manage to wield this properly. So today, the main goal is to tell you about the latest results from the TDK experiment, which we've been running for the past several years, and we hope to continue to run for a while. So you probably know about this, but sometime in the late 60s, after developing hydrogen bombs and stuff, Andrei Sakharov basically wrote down some prescriptions for how the universe could become matter-dominated. And so there were sort of basically three points. One is that there has to be some source of baryon violation. Second, that somehow matter and antimatter in the form of C or CP violation must exist. And then finally, the universe had to have some kind of departure from thermal equilibrium so as not to wash out any asymmetry that may have been generated by these asymmetries, asymmetrical processes. So then, I think it's been sort of a perennial challenge as to quantitatively really explaining how this happened. And so in terms of cosmological observations, basically sort of looking at the amount of matter out there and the photons out there, we now know that somehow matter and antimatter were probably created in equal parts to something like 1 part in 10 billion. And so that minute imbalance is basically what prevented the complete ion annihilation and resulted in us existing as matter today. So on one hand, it's an extraordinarily small number, right? 1 part in 10 billion. But I think one of the challenges has been to sort of connect this to our known particle physics and have the sort of sources of CP violation that can actually generate this kind of asymmetry. And so far, it's been a real challenge, and it just seems that the one known source of CP violation in particle physics, in the quark sector, in quark mixing, cannot seem to produce this asymmetry and falls by many orders short. So in that sense, the number is also very large. And so, that sort of brings you to the conclusion that further exploration and elucidations of possible sources of CP violation is really critical towards understanding or to elucidating this problem. So that brings me to the topic of neutrinos. So in the standard model, we will have three neutrinos, which correspond to the electron and muon and tau. And so as you probably know, under the weak charge current, basically, one of these neutrino species turns into their corresponding lepton. And then, likewise, there are the corresponding antineutrinos, which will produce a corresponding antilepton upon interaction. And so the study of neutrinos, this is also probably very well known to you, has been really challenging because of the small cross-sections for interaction. And so here you can see, as a function of neutrino energy, so this is in GeV, 1 GeV, 10 GeV, 100 GeV. Most of our sort of accelerator-based experiments, the ones I'll be talking about, sort of operate in this region around here, around 1 GeV. And that's hard to read, but so that's 10 to the minus 38 centimeters squared. And so you can see that we're talking about cross-sections that are under 10 to the minus 38, 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared on a nucleon. There's no need to go through the math, but yeah, that leads to an interaction length that's on the order of light years. And in comparison, another sort of commonly known neutral particle, the photon, the radiation length for that is something like a half a centimeter. And so one of the, at least from a practical experimental standpoint, is how do you deal with these very small cross-sections for neutrinos and even smaller for antineutrinos interacting on matter? So I'll come back to that question later. And so that brings me to the question, the topic of neutrino oscillations. As you know from our, as you know now that neutrinos, a flavor state is actually a linear combination of mass eigenstates. And so as a result of time evolution or propagation through space-time, these mass eigenstates will evolve differently in time. And as a result, you can acquire a component of a different flavor even if you start with a pure flavor eigenstate at t equals zero. And so the oscillation probability, at least in vacuum, is given by this formula here. And what this basically shows is that the oscillation probability is sort of the sum of sinusoidal terms and the distance the neutrino travels between production and interaction divided by its energy with a wavelength in this argument given by the square mass differences and then an amplitude, which is given by the elements of this mixing matrix. Okay. And so, as we'll see, there are additional effects in the presence of matter. So if we specialize to the case of what we know in the standard model right now is of three neutrinos, so in that case, we have three flavor eigenstates, three mass eigenstates, and this unitary matrix, 3x3 unitary matrix, which relates those two. So yeah, the standard parameterization has us decompose this unitary matrix into three parts, basically 3 2-by-2 rotations, and then a complex phase here, and then additional possible complex phases if the neutrino is Majorana. So I should point out that this is actually wrong. This matrix should be over here and that one over there to get the standard parameterization. Of course, it's just conventional, but the convention works that way. And so that's one thing. The other thing is, of course, that we have mass eigenstates and mass eigenvalues. And so from what we know, basically there is sort of a large splitting, which we sometimes call the atmospheric mass splitting, which corresponds to around 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3 eV squared. And then a small splitting, sometimes called the solar splitting, which is around 7.8 10 to the minus 5 eV squared. So about a factor of 30 between this small splitting and the big splitting. And so one of the other big questions is, what is the so-called mass ordering? Whether this the small splitting is on top like this or on the bottom, which leads to what we call either the normal hierarchy or normal ordering, which is sort of akin to what we see in the quark sector, or the inverted hierarchy, which would be an interesting situation.
Alpha 1, alpha 2 are
there? Not through neutrino oscillations, right? So you can probably convince yourself because they're on the diagonal, they basically, those phases will cancel out in an expression like that. Right? In neutrinoless double beta decay, I think in principle they are detectable, but yeah, we'll see whether, I think we'll be in a great shape if we get to a point where we can say that neutrinoless double beta decay occurs and also be sensitive to those phases. So it's all news now, but you know that that Nobel Prize last year was given to basically the discovery of neutrino oscillations, which showed, first of all, that this neutrino flavor change that results from neutrino mass occurs, and by virtue of the fact that we see it, also the fact that neutrinos have non-zero and non-degenerate masses. Right? So that brings me to the experiment that I'll talk about today, which is T to K. And so the basic idea is that we have an accelerator complex, which produces for us a muon neutrino beam, which goes 295 kilometers across Japan to the Super K detector. And so en route, neutrino oscillation effects will occur. And so that muon neutrino beam will become a combination of muon electron and tau neutrino beams. We can also, as I'll describe later, produce an anti-neutrino beam and study the corresponding anti-neutrino oscillations with the same setup. Okay. And so it's a relatively large collaboration, 400 to 500 collaborators, 58 institutions, and actually 11 nations now, not 12. So the neutrino.
What happened to the
12th country? This was South Korea. And so they basically, you know, there's a relatively small community, and they've been entirely focused on the Reno experiment. And so they just said that we don't have the resources or the time to really continue. Yeah. So producing the neutrino beam. So we get 30 GeV protons coming out of this J Park main ring, and they get extracted, and then they strike, where'd it go? Oh, here it is. Yeah, so they come out of this beam line, and they strike a carbon target where they induce pion production. And then the pion production, well, the pions come in two signs, and then we have these, a series of electromagnets, which we call horns, and they basically make sort of this toroidal magnetic field. And so for most of the time, we've set the polarity of those magnets to focus positive pions into this sort of 100 meter long decay region where they decay to produce muon neutrinos.
All those neutrino sources, they all use light elements, right? So as a primary target, right? So Fermilab is beryllium
The Busa neutrino beamline uses beryllium. The NUMMI beamline uses carbon, like we do. Yeah, and it's basically to, the target
is. The interaction length of pions is long, right?
It's depending on the material. So in this case, it's probably something like 80 centimeters or something like that. But yeah, by going to a low Z material, you actually minimize the re-interaction of the pions as they get produced. And there's also, you know, depending on the material, some benefit from the standpoint of producing radioactive nuclei, or long-lived radioactive nuclei. Mm-hmm. And also beryllium and carbon, is obviously enormous thermal shock that occurs when you have sort of a megawatt of beam hitting the target. And so there's also mechanical considerations in the choice of that. Yeah, so right now we're focusing positive particles, and then we can reverse the polarity and apparently get charge violation. That should be pi minus going to mu minus nu mu bar. And we can produce anti-muon neutrino beams to study neutrino oscillations. We also, in this experiment, this is actually the first experiment to use an interesting technique where we actually point the neutrino beam away slightly from the super K detector. This is why we call it the off-axis technique. And so what happens is that if you go directly on the beam axis, you get the most number of neutrinos, but a lot of them are actually at higher energies. And so given the 295 kilometer distance and the mass splitting around 2.4, 2.5, 10 to the minus EV squared, the oscillation maximum is actually, maximum effects actually occur at 600 MeV. And so by sort of steering the beam slightly away from where your detector, you can actually maximize the flux at that, where the oscillation maximum effects are maximum. In this case, 600 MeV, and that in our case corresponds to 2.5 degrees. So the beam is actually directed 2.5 degrees away from the super K detector. And so here is a predicted neutrino flux. So you can see that in neutrino mode, as you expect, it's primarily muon neutrinos. We do get contamination from muon antineutrinos and then also electron neutrinos. When we flip the polarity of the beam, the electromagnets, now you can see that the muon antineutrinos are the dominant component, followed by muon neutrinos and electron neutrinos. So obviously, these electron neutrinos are an important consideration for background when we're studying muon neutrino to electron neutrino oscillations. And the other thing you see is that somehow the setup remembers the fact that you're plowing positive particles in. So we get slightly higher positive pion production than negative pion production initially. And which is why you can see that at the flux level already the contamination of neutrinos in antineutrino mode is larger than in the reverse case. And on top of that, we also have this issue that because of helicity effects, the antineutrino cross-section is a factor of 3 or 4 lower than the neutrino cross-sections. So in a neutrino case, everything works for you and the what we call the wrong sign component, the antineutrinos and neutrino beam is at the few percent level. But in the antineutrino case, it works in the opposite direction. And so you have neutrino contamination at the sort of 10% level. In this case, for us, when we talk about colliders, we usually talk about integrated luminosity as sort of the currency for how much data we have. For us, it's protons on target. How many 30 GeV protons do we send to the target and the neutrinos that result? So here are the... So we have that sort of three-flavor neutrino oscillation formula. And so if we specialize in the case of a T decay, these are sort of the relevant formulas that we have for ample of muon neutrino staying a muon neutrino, the so-called muon neutrino disappearance measurement. And so that primarily is sensitive to, first of all, this mass splitting here, the large atmospheric mass splitting, and this mixing angle, the two-fold mixing angle, sine squared 2 theta 2 3. At least in the standard model where we have CPT symmetry, the disappearance modes are supposed to be the same between neutrino and antineutrino mode. And so we can also do CPT tests with antineutrino modes. I don't know why all my bars have disappeared, but okay. As it turns out, which will be relevant later, in principle, one can also do the same thing with electron neutrinos, right? And in which case, if you work out the matrix elements, what you're primarily sensitive to is sine squared 2 theta 1 3. But so far, in an accelerator, we haven't found a way to make pure electron neutrino beams. That measurement is done by reactors, nuclear reactors with low energy neutrinos, a much shorter baseline. But in the end, they get a very precise measurement of sine squared 2 theta 1 3, much as we can measure sine squared 2 theta 2 3. So a much more complicated and I like to say richer environment is the so-called a muon neutrino to electron neutrino appearance signal. And so you can see that this is actually quite complicated. So in the leading order, we have the sine squared 2 theta 1 3 term. We have sine squared theta 2 3, not sine squared 2 theta 2 3, but theta 2 3. We have a dependence on this CP odd phase delta. And so this will actually switch sign depending on what you're considering neutrinos or antineutrino mode. And then finally, we have matter effects, which are in this case parameterized by this parameter called x here. There are a number of interesting things here. So first, you notice that in order for this to at least happen at the atmospheric scale, we need to have theta 1 3 not equal to 0. The other thing that we need to have with theta 1 3 not equal to 0 is that In order to have the CPE violation, you have to have all three mixing angles non-zero. And so with theta 1,3 now established to be non-zero, we can expect to see CPE violating effects. So this sine squared theta 2,3 is also interesting relative to this, because here there's sort of a twofold degeneracy, right? On either side of 45 degrees, you end up with the same oscillation probability. Whereas here, this leading order term distinguishes between greater than 45 degrees and less than 45 degrees. And so this is what we call the octant of theta 2,3. And then, yeah, finally, there's a CP violating effect that in some sense, is the primary goal now of T decay. And so based on the parameters that we know, the maximum effect here, basically the amplitude of this term here, is around 30%. So the oscillation probability will vary by about 30% as you go around in delta. And the matter of fact, depending on which hierarchy you have, is around plus or minus 10%. So since this equation is a somewhat complicated, I just made sort of this cartoon to illustrate how things change with these parameters. And so you have theta 2,3, delta CP, and the hierarchy here. And so I set this to pi over 4, delta CP equal to 0, and the normal hierarchy. And so on the left, you have the nu mu to nu e oscillation probability as a function of neutrino energy at 295 kilometers, and a corresponding anti-neutrino channel probabilities. So you can see already, even though delta CP equals 0, the neutrino oscillation probability is slightly higher than the anti-neutrino probability. And that's a result of the matter effect. And we'll see that we'll switch when we go to inverted hierarchy. So the first thing we can do is, well, let's say we can crank up theta 2,3 a little bit. And so you can see that both the neutrino and anti-neutrino oscillation probabilities go up. Okay? So that's not too surprising. That's something that affects both channels equally. So we bring it back to pi over 4. The next thing we can do is sort of rotate this CP violating phase to minus pi over 2. Hopefully you can see it here. That enhances the neutrino mode but suppresses the anti-neutrino oscillations. Okay? And so not surprisingly, if you go to plus pi over 2, that's pi. And so this is an interesting case where the CP phase is not 0, but there's no CP violation. Okay? And so you can see here that in both cases, for neutrino and anti-neutrino mode, the oscillation probability kind of shifts to a lower energy. And not surprisingly, if you go to plus pi over 2, the neutrino oscillations are suppressed, and the anti-neutrino oscillations are enhanced. And finally, if we keep all the parameters the same and go to the inverted hierarchy, now you can see that the neutrino oscillations are suppressed, and the anti-neutrino oscillations get a small enhancement. Okay. So that's just a sort of a quick tour through the relevant parameters. And yeah, we also have experiments not T decay that are at, let's say, a longer baseline. In these cases, the difference between normal hierarchy and inverted hierarchy and the oscillation probability is larger. And so they will have a better sensitivity to this mass hierarchy. And so when we talk about the NOVA experiment, we'll see some of that later. So just to make a quick summary, in terms of this CP violating parameter delta CP that we're after, right? If delta CP is 0 or pi, or sine delta is 0, then there's no CP violation, and the vacuum oscillation probabilities are equal for neutrino and antineutrino mode. If we go to delta CP equals minus pi over 2, so this is a sort of a maximal case where we maximally enhance nu mu to nu e oscillations and suppress the antineutrino oscillations. Delta CP equals plus pi over 2, there's obviously the opposite case. In terms of theta 2,3 and theta 1,3, if we increase these, then we enhance both channels. And then as far as the hierarchy is concerned, if we have normal, we enhance the neutrino channel, suppress the anti-neutrino channel, and vice versa for the inverted hierarchy. And yeah, it's interesting, right? Because this is a sort of a fixed plus or minus 10% effect, whereas these are just sort of representative maximal values where overall the effect is up to 30%, depending on the value of delta CP. Yeah, in principle, yes. So obviously, it doesn't manifest as an asymmetry, but as you'll see, in principle, we can measure the spectrum itself. And so if we know what the initial muon neutrino spectrum is, then yeah, we should see that the oscillations, the electron neutrinos should have more low energy neutrinos relative to delta CP equals 0 in the case of pi. So yeah, in principle, that's measurable. It will take some statistics, but yeah, we can do it. So as far as how we observe the neutrino interactions, at these energies of around 600 MeV, 1 GeV, the primary channel is the so-called charge current quasi-elastic channel, and that's where the neutrino interacts with a nucleon within a nucleus and turns into a lepton, and then basically doesn't induce any pion production. And so the proton, being a heavy particle, is typically below the Cherenkov threshold. And so the signature of this is a single muon or electron-like ring. And so you get a very clean signature in a wired Cherenkov detector, which allows you to, at least via this channel, tell you that you have a muon neutrino or an electron neutrino interacting. So the other nice thing about this is that assuming this kinematics, you can actually infer the neutrino energy via the outgoing lepton momentum, basically the magnitude of the momentum and the direction relative to the beam. In terms of the backgrounds, we have various pion production channels where we can produce pi zeros, or there's a neutral current pi zero production channel, as well as charge current pion production channels. And so, yeah, the water Cherenkov detectors actually have a relatively powerful capability to detect multiple particles by finding multiple rings. And so we have a number of ways to eliminate these backgrounds by doing a ring counting analysis and requiring that there's only one ring. We also have a second handle, which comes from decay electrons. So if there is a pi plus, for example, produced in the event, that pi plus should come to rest, decay into a muon, and then decay into an electron. And so some microseconds later, we should see some additional activity related to the decay of the muon, which would also allow us to eliminate the possibility of, helps to suppress the probability of these charged pions being produced in the event.
So these energies, the muons stop
everything? I'm sorry?
And these energies, muons are stored within the volume of the
particle? Yeah, so you know, sort of 1 GeV neutrino will typically produce 700 MeV, 700 MeV muon. Right. And so so those will go a few meters. And so a few meters is, yeah, something that fits within the super K detector, which is about 40 meters in diameter. Okay, so in terms of the analysis strategy, well, what do we do? So we basically need to predict, as a function of neutrino oscillation parameters, at the distance 295 kilometers, how many electron neutrinos, how many muon neutrinos and their spectrum, as well as their backgrounds. And so that tells us what kind of neutrinos are actually present within the beam after the oscillation after the oscillation effects. And so we have some flux of neutrinos based on this, multiplied by a cross section, an efficiency for the far detector, multiplied by the oscillation probability. And so to predict a neutrino flux, we have the simulation that we had before, which is tuned to various data to try to make it as accurate as possible. We have a neutrino interaction model, which not only tells us what the overall cross section is, but how many events go into each channel and what the final state of those channels are. And then finally, a detailed detector simulation to tell us, what is the response of that other detector to an interaction from this neutrino beam. Now, one issue is that there's actually a relatively large uncertainty in these two parameters. And so an essential part of the strategy is to place a near detector. So this is a detector which is right outside the neutrino source, where effectively L over E is zero. And so we observe the neutrino beam prior to the effect of neutrino oscillations. And so by sort of using this information, basically we are observing the same flux and cross section as we do in the far detector, absent the oscillation effects. And so we can cancel to a large extent the uncertainties that are present here, leaving us with the uncertainties here. And then once we have this prediction, we can compare that to the data and do a likelihood analysis in order to extract the oscillation parameters. Okay? So just going back a little bit in history, so this would be circa 2013. This is when we observed a significant excess of electron neutrino candidates in the muon neutrino beam. So this is the expected background. In blue, this is the data. And so this was the first definitive observation of muon neutrino to electron neutrino oscillations. In the same data, we looked at the muon neutrinos. And so that's plotted as a function of neutrino energy, but this one is as a function of L over E. And so in the absence of oscillation effects, we expect this spectrum here. And so you can see that there's an enormous suppression in the deficit in the muon neutrino events that is modeled very well by neutrino oscillations that arises from the fact that the muon neutrinos are turning partly into electron neutrinos and partly into tau neutrinos. And so, what's always been interesting is that at least in our data, this effect, sine squared theta 2,3, has been maximal near 0.5. And so as a result of this data, we made the most precise measurement of theta 2,3. And so what's new since then is that, well, first of all, we've been fortunate to have a steady increase in beam power. So that's like LHC luminosity going up. And since 2014, our beam power has nearly doubled. So that's good news. And then the other thing we did was all the previous results were with a neutrino beam, where we're studying neutrino oscillations. And since then, we ran primarily with an anti-neutrino beam. And so now we actually have about equal amounts of POT in neutrino and anti-neutrino mode. Okay, so what do we see with this data? So in neutrino mode, we actually haven't taken that much more neutrino data, so it's not too different. But at least for the muon neutrino candidates, we expect 481 events in the absence of oscillations, but then 135 events are observed. And so you can see we still see this very, very nice neutrino oscillation pattern. And now with a bit of additional data, we expect something like 6 events background, and we observe 32 events in a new median new mean oscillation channel. So now in the antineutrinos sector, we see a similar muon antineutrino disappearance. And yeah, maybe the first, I don't want to say hints, but that's basically our electron antineutrino sample. We expect something like 2.4 events in the background, but we observe only 4. And so yeah, this actually turns out to be, at least from in terms of the sensitivity or the results from our experiment, somewhat interesting, as I'll talk about in a little bit. So in terms of just guessing where we are, well, what does this mean in terms of oscillation parameters? So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to actually combine all 4 modes of oscillations, muon neutrino disappearance, muon antineutrino disappearance, electron neutrino appearance, and electron antineutrino disappearance, basically to try to maximize our constraints on all the parameters simultaneously in a consistent analysis. And so that's actually quite a complicated process. And so maybe it's sort of, in some sense, the data is already telling you what it's going to say in some sense. So what I show here is the number of electron neutrino events, number of electron antineutrino events as a function of hierarchy and the CP phase. And so hopefully you can see that, as we saw before, this is just a quantitative statement that when we have normal hierarchy, the neutrino oscillations are favored and antineutrino oscillations are suppressed. And likewise, with delta CP equals minus pi over 2, you maximize neutrino oscillations and suppress the antineutrino oscillations. And so if you compare these numbers, right, you observe 32 in neutrino mode and 4 in antineutrino mode. Basically, we're seeing, the data is going to favor this, the neutrino data is going to favor this, but the antineutrino data also is going to favor this, because this is a case which gives you the least number of events. And so what we're going to see is basically the data is going to favor this combination of normal hierarchy and delta CP equals minus pi over 2, which is just from this counting analysis something that's apparent. And so we'll see that a bit more quantitatively. So in terms of the allowed regions of in the parameter space, there's a band here. So this is sine squared theta 1,3 versus the CP phase. And there's a band here, a very narrow band here, which corresponds to the reactor measurements of sine squared theta 1,3. So our allowed regions contours are given by this here. And so you can see that the best fit point is indeed around delta CP equals minus pi over 2, this favoring plus pi over 2, which would sort of give you the opposite enhancements in neutrino and antineutrino mode, and for the first time, a closed contour. So then what we can do is actually employ the constraint from the theta 1,3 measurements, the reactor theta 1,3 measurements, to see how our data looks like once you incorporate that information. So note that the horizontal axis changes drastically here. So we're focusing on a very narrow region of sine squared theta 1,3, around which are consistent with the reactor measurements. And then and we combine that with our data. And these are the contours we obtain for delta CP versus sine squared theta 1,3. So in fact, already with the neutrino data, we already had some hint of this. So this is absent the antineutrino data. So here are the reactor measurements here. And the delta CP and sine squared theta 1,3 that's allowed by our neutrino data is given by this sort of wavy thing here. And so once again, you can see that this region around delta Cp equals minus pi over 2 is already favored given the reactor measurement and our neutrino data in the absence of antineutrino data. And that just comes back to the fact that we see a large number of electron neutrinos. And given the theta 1-3 that we get from the reactors, that required that favors having delta Cp around minus pi over 2. Yeah.
Last slide, you showed the observed number, but then for
So, well, in terms of the amount of predicted events, the error on that we're achieving is something on the order of, I would say, 5 to 7%. So that's the central value, right? And then, of course, we account for the statistical, expect the statistical fluctuations when we, or statistical uncertainties when we, and also the systematic uncertainties in those predictions when we draw these contours. So then the other parameter is theta 2-3. And so what we see here is sine squared theta 2-3 versus the mass splitting. So this is the allowed region in the normal hierarchy, so delta M squared positive, and this is the allowed region in the inverted hierarchy. And so we have allowed regions in both. And but you can see that, for example, sine squared theta 2-3 continues to favor values around 0.5. So this is theta 2-3 around pi over 4, maximal mixing. But recently we had results from NOVA. And so here's our result, or this is, this is our current result now in black. The yellow is results from IceCube. Red is some results from Minos. But then the recent NOVA data in green is actually favoring non-maximal theta 2-3. And because they're not actually doing a joint analysis, they have this degeneracy depending on which side of the octant they have. So yeah, I'm always a bit curious what these things look like, and I always feel like it's something out of Pokemon Go. There's actually even a character in Japan called the dripping panda, tare panda. So when you have these, I'm actually hoping for sort of non-maximal theta 2-3s, because they'll be interesting. Anyways, so far we've seen the results in terms of delta Cp and theta 1-3. We can actually sort of isolate our statement on delta Cp and by marginalizing over the parameters. And so one way to look at this is to plot effectively the delta chi-squared as a function of delta Cp after marginalizing over all the parameters separately for normal hierarchy and an inverted hierarchy. And so you can see our best fit point around here, around minus pi over 2. And then you can see that we disfavor plus pi over 2. And likewise, the inverted hierarchy is disfavored to some extent. But even in inverted hierarchy, we would also favor around minus pi over 2. So that's one way to look at the data. So we're just sort of a frequentist way to look at it. Another way to look at this is Bayesian posterior density. And so if we do that, we do a Markov chain Monte Carlo analysis, and then we look at the posterior probability density that's consistent with our data, then, so this is a bit confusing, right? Here, down is favored, but here, probability density is favors upward. And so you can see, once again, that we're favoring minus pi over 2, and then disfavoring plus pi over 2. But then you probably know from all Bayesian analyses that we have to assume some kind of prior, right? And so this is assuming delta Cp is basically flat, and we don't have any preference in delta Cp. We could use another assumption where, for example, sine delta Cp, basically the amplitude of the Cp violating term is flat, and then plot this versus sine delta Cp. So that corresponds to minus pi over 2, that's plus pi over 2. And so you can see statements like whether 0 or pi are within the 90% credible interval do depend on our prior. And so that sort of indicates that our data is still quite weak and more statistics are needed before we really have any definitive statements. I mean, it's definitely, numbers themselves, you can sort of see a weak preference for the delta Cp equals minus pi over 2. But yeah, before we make any definitive statements, we certainly need more statistics. So the other interesting thing was we have the theta 2-3 which also affects the oscillation probability and the mass hierarchy. And so we can do a similar thing in the frequentist analysis, the Bayesian analysis, and marginalize over all the parameters except these two, and basically take the probability density, which is in the lower octant, theta 2-3 less than pi over 4, or theta 2-3 greater than pi over 4, and also split it up between normal hierarchy and inverted hierarchy. And so, once again, you can see that the probability density favors the combinations which increase the neutrino oscillation probability. So most of it is in the second octet in normal hierarchy. And so based on this, you can see that the normal hierarchy posterior probability is something like 72% versus 28% for inverted hierarchy, 68% for the second octant, higher octant versus the lower octant. So yeah, sometimes this is characterized as sort of a Bayes factor. And so in this case, this is something like 2.5. And I'm always asked what that means, but if you go back to Jeffries actually has sort of these qualitative statements to go around with certain values of Bayes factors. And for 2.5, I think the words he uses are barely worth mentioning. So you can mention it, but it's not too significant. So there's another experiment that started probably 2 years ago, called NOVA. And it's a very similar experiment. We start with an accelerator at Fermilab to produce a neutrino beam that goes 810 kilometers to the detector.
But the first results a year ago, so it's less than
2 years ago, yeah. I think it was 2014. But the detector technology is very, very different. They have these active scintillating tracking detectors. And so this is an example of a muon candidate going through the detector. And so it's actually a very, very nice, capable detector. And because of the fact that they are about nearly three times the distance of between the accelerator and T decay, there are basically two things. They operate at a higher energy, something like 2 GeV, so about three times what we operate at T decay, also employing the off-axis technique. And also they have larger matter effects, so they're more sensitive to the hierarchy than T decay. And so this is what they see. Yeah, you can't look at that anymore without seeing something anthropomorphic. So like in T decay, here's what they expect from the muon neutrinos in the absence of oscillation effects. Here's what they observe. So you can see there's an enormous deficit. Here's the ratio. They also see, except maybe a high energy is a pattern which is consistent with neutrino oscillations. But as stated before, despite this large disappearance, they're basically concluding that the effect is not quite maximal. And so it is pulled away from theta 2.3 equals 0.5. And so they're saying that theta 2.3 equals pi over 4 is excluded by something like 2.5 sigma.
That one energy beam is very tiny.
Yeah, that one, yeah. So that's another issue that the quality of their fit is actually not very good. So if you look at I can't remember what the chi-square per degree of freedom is, but the chi-square probability is something on the order of 10 to the minus 4. And so, yeah, they're saying that, mainly that's probably driven by statistical fluctuations here, giving them not such a great agreement out there. But that's, we'll just have to see what they do with more data. They observe 33 electron neutrino candidates. So they haven't run an anti-neutrino mode yet. So they see 33 electron neutrino candidates. And I don't know how informative this is, but basically this is the 1, 2 sigma, 3 sigma allowed range as a function of delta CP, and not sine squared theta 1.3, but sine squared theta 2.3. And so I'm not sure what to say about this, but maybe I can go to the next plot where we are constraining the theta 1.3 based on the reactor results. And so as a result, some regions in inverted hierarchy, this is actually a relatively large amount of appearance signal that they're seeing. They're starting to exclude regions of the inverted hierarchy, even at 3 sigma, and favoring the normal hierarchy. And so that might be more easily seen here. And so this is sort of a graphical version of the table I showed for NOVA. So this is the expected number of electron neutrino candidates they would observe for the normal hierarchy as a function of delta CP, and then likewise for the inverted hierarchy. And so they observe 33 events, which is this line here. And so you can see that most lines, most of the region in the inverted hierarchy is not consistent with that, and so they are favoring the normal hierarchy. So this is sort of a global snapshot of all the information that's out there. And it's really confusing because in a T decay, even though we agree on what the parameter is called, and T decay, delta CP ranges from minus pi to pi, and NOVA ranges from 0 to 2 pi. And then at super K, they divide by pi. It's just 0 to 2 pi, but you divide by pi. So I think you can map this axis to that one, but then basically here to here appears here to there, and then you go back around like this. You go back around this way for that plot over there. So if you take a look here, as we said in for T decay, we are favoring delta Cp equals minus pi over 2 slightly, and an even smaller preference for normal hierarchy versus inverted hierarchy. Nova is sort of favoring the normal hierarchy. They have their statement about delta Cp is a little bit weaker. And then likewise, a super K with their atmospheric data is also favoring delta Cp equals 3 pi over 2, which is actually delta equal Cp equals minus pi over 2, with a slight preference for the normal hierarchy versus inverted hierarchy. So taken all together, you know, the global picture is that you have three experiments that are slightly favoring the normal hierarchy, and delta Cp equals minus pi over 2. Okay, so that's where things stand as of at least this summer. And so as I said before, basically all the experiments need to take more data in order to reach somewhat more definitive conclusions about Cp violation and the mass hierarchy. And so this brings up the issue of what I call neutrino economics. And so TDK is supposed to run until around 2021 and accumulate 7.8 times 10 to the 21 POT. So that's about roughly five times the amount of data that we have now. And so if we project to the future and see what kind of how many events we expect, this is sort of a table showing how many events in total we would expect for delta Cp equals 0, and this is all normal hierarchy, and minus delta Cp equals minus pi over 2 in neutrino and anti-neutrino mode. So you can see that if you take, you can just do the statistics in your head, this is sort of a 25 event difference with an uncertainty of around 10. And so you're looking at sort of a two sigma effect even after 2021, and even weaker in the anti-neutrino mode. And so basically we need to have more statistics, and there's only so much there. You can't change the cross section, you can't change the oscillation form probability. You could do something about the detector technology, but in the end what it comes down to is that you need a more intense neutrino source and a bigger detector. And so that's gonna define sort of a two-step strategy, first by increasing the neutrino flux. And so, as I mentioned before, there's been some really dramatic improvements in the J. Park accelerator performance. And so right now, upgrade to the accelerator has been approved. So that allows the accelerator to basically function twice as fast and double the power, and so give us something like more than 700 kilowatt beam. Okay, and so the design is 750 kilowatts with that upgrade. And so that design performance appears to be within reach. And so as of like a year ago, we actually didn't know whether this was going to happen or not. But as of January this year, the Japanese government approved this upgrade. And so now the accelerator people at JPARC are planning not only for 750 kilowatts, they actually think they can also fundamentally improve the accelerator tuning and reach something like 1.3 megawatts, so that we'll be accumulating data something like three times faster than we are now. And so as a result of this, within TDK, we started to look into extending the TDK run to something like 2026 and accumulating three times more data. And so yeah, you just take the previous numbers and divide by or multiply by 20 over 7.8, and so these are the numbers that we get, and so you can see that we can expect something like a 90 event difference in the neutrino mode, and maybe 20 events in the anti-neutrino mode, and so that is showing that sort of we can get to sort of the three sigma level with this upgrade or an extension of the run, but there are some other elements that are involved. First is that these electromagnets that we've been operating at are actually operated at 250 kiloamps, whereas they're designed for 320 kiloamps. And the reason for this is that, why do we have an old power supply? But for whatever reason, we have a very old power supply that's powering this horn. And so people have been worried that it will just break. And so we actually, this summer, are replacing the power supplies, and that'll allow us to get to 320 kiloamps. This is basically the amount of neutrino flux that we get as a function of the current. And so we can expect about 10% more neutrinos or anti-neutrinos per POT with that upgrade. And then the other thing we've been looking at is, this sort of comes down to the fiducial volume issue that we've been using. So the first thing you notice is that we only use these single ring events in super K. We can, in principle, use the multi-ring samples as well, so long as we can tag the electron and the muon. So we're working on that. And we can also, so we think we can get about 20% more statistics out of that, based on that. And then also, this fiducial volume, instead of going, we don't think we need to actually need to take 2 meters out of the fiducial volume. We can probably go to, by using a more intelligent definition, get another 20 or 30% out of that. And so we are sort of projecting that we can get something like 40 or 50% more statistics out of the super K detector per POT as well. So the bottom line there is the, here are some of the sensitivities. And so this is the significance of a CP violating effect as a function of the true delta CP. And so in these favorable cases, which are sort of indicated by the current data, we should be able to exceed 3 sigma. And then, in terms of theta 2-3, if the theta 2-3 really is not maximal at the level that's consistent with the current NOVA central values, we should be able to definitively see very strong evidence that the that this parameter is not maximal. There was a question about systematics. And so this is basically the uncertainty that we have in predicting the number of events in any given sample. So this is the neutrino mode muon sample, the neutrino mode anti-neutrino sample, electron sample. And so you can see that it's around 6 to 7%. And unfortunately, with the level of statistics that we have, that we would expect with this extended run, it does have an actual significant impact on the expected sensitivity. And so this is basically the significance of a CP violating effect at delta CP equals minus pi over 2 with various values of sine squared theta 2, 3. And so if we didn't have systematic errors, we would get these solid curves. But then with these dash curves, that reflects the impact of our current systematic uncertainties. And as it turns out, the largest uncertainties are coming from various cross-section related uncertainties, as well as super K detector modeling uncertainties. And so we have to do better on these in order to not allow us to take too much of a hit in terms of the eventual sensitivity. So this is where things like new PRISM come in, where so one of the big issues is how we map, how we actually determine the neutrino energy. And so for example, when we wanted to see a difference between delta CP equals zero and pi, we're relying on our ability to basically reconstruct the neutrino energy spectrum of the oscillated events. But that means that we have to have a very good accurate representation between the true neutrino energy and what we infer from the outgoing particles that we actually detect. And so there's actually a real chicken and egg problem here, because we don't know what the incoming neutrino energy is. So in order to map something as a function of neutrino energy, we have to use a reconstructed neutrino energy. But then that's the thing that we're questioning. So how do we actually tie that back to the true neutrino energy? And so what the new PRISM concept actually allows us to do is that we mentioned before this off-axis effect, where the neutrino energy spectrum actually varies. So when you're directly on axis, it's at highest energy. And when you go to further and further off axis, the energy spectrum becomes narrower and shifts to lower energy. And so basically by taking data at all these off axis angles under an environment where we are actually controlling the neutrino energy spectrum, we can isolate the response of the detector to neutrinos at a very particular energy. And so this is sort of a new concept that we're developing now. And it seems to work actually very well in constraining the systematics that are sort of most prevalent in the current analysis, and so we're trying to push this forward.
Just to ask, why is it easier to move the detector rather than, like, say, change the deflection of the beam a bit?
In principle, it would be. And so what it comes down to is that you might recall that there was this. There's this, we have sort of the production target, and then there's this long decay volume, right, where we focus the pions into.
Yeah.
And basically this is an excavation, which is probably the dominant cost of this beam line. Yeah. And so, yeah, the accelerator can sort of move the beam around, but basically this decay pipe is narrow enough that if you deflected the beam by more than half a degree, basically you'd be driving the pions into the wall of this beam line.
Okay.
So yeah, that would be
space.
Yeah. So if you just had a bigger a bigger decay region, you would be able to do that.
But excavating this shot.
Well, that's already built, so we can't change that. But. Yeah, I remember that something like reducing this decay volume by 10 meters save something like $30 million, which is about twice the cost of this. Yeah. So I'll skip that. So yeah, the other part of this, obviously, is, well, we dealt with the neutrino flux. We can also just make a bigger detector. And so that's where we come to hyper-K. And so there, you know, we expect to have something like a factor of 15 more statistics. And so with there, over a large part of the parameter space, we will be able to measure, to detect CP violation at the phi sigma level, as well as doing, you know, well, obviously we've been looking for things like proton decay and super K for a long time, but this would really sort of open up another frontier in detecting proton decay at other, you know, neutrino astrophysics and other topics. So I'm coming to the end of the talk. So so just, you know, if you look historically, you know, it was around 1964. Or I guess already 40 years ago that, you know, 50 years ago that we discovered CP violation in the kaon system. And it took 50 years for us to actually, you know, through a combination of kaon experiments, B factories, and what else was involved here? You know, measuring various sides of the CKM matrix, looking at CP asymmetries and things like J-psi, K-short, B to pi-pi, and whatever, to actually come up with a consistent picture of why that CP violation exists, right? Or why is it there? And does it explain all the things that we see in the quark sector? And so likewise, for me, you know, observing CP violation in the neutrino sector, if we see it, some asymmetry between neutrinos and antineutrinos, that for me sort of defines the beginning of a program where now we have to elucidate, well, to see whether the standard neutrino mixing paradigm actually explains what we see. And the other thing I see is that quite apart from CP violation, there are already mysteries here. And so if you look at, here's our lepton mixing matrix as we see it now. And so you can see it has it has these very large elements, whereas the quark sector it basically has a pseudo-diagonal structure where transitions are favoring staying within generations. So I like to say this is sort of pseudo-monogamous, and this one is maximally promiscuous in the mixing relationship. So that's one issue. And you know, you could say that, you know, this one is normal and that one's weird, or this one is normal and that one's weird. But yeah, in the end, you know, the standard model doesn't tell us what these numbers are, apart from the fact that they are unitary. And so there's a question. So I think, yeah, somehow that question has been left behind. And then second, another thing is just the vast range of masses that these particles occupy, in particular the neutrino, which is almost six orders of magnitude from the next nearest you know, a particle which is supposedly very closely related to it. And that suggests that, you know, there may be some different form of mass involved. And so if you just put things on a scale, something like one EV to the heaviest particle is about to span between the mass of an ant and the largest living creatures that we know of. And so, yeah, so that points to the fact that an ant is you know, somehow a different being than a whale. But then, yeah, if you sort of start looking at, and so that, you know, so biology itself sort of has its own limits on how much dynamic range it has in a given kind of species to produce different masses. So for ants, it's actually very small. It's only about an order of magnitude. What's interesting is for mammals is that the lightest mammal, this is Struscan shrew, is actually around here on this scale. And so in this case, the explanation is that, you know, these are both mammals and they are sort of have a common origin. And so in the end, it's just evolution and just the way things turn out that these things turn out to be of such different scales. And it's entirely possible, right, that in the end that there's actually no explanation for these masses. They are just what they are, just to put more perspective on where these things are. So finally, I think also this question about whether theta 2-3, delta CP, are actually taking some special values is an interesting question. And so we come back in 20 years and tell you that theta 2-3 looks like it really is pi over 4, and delta CP is really looking like it's minus pi over 2. I think that would also be a very puzzling situation. You know, if you just had some other number like delta theta 2-3 is 0.42 and delta CP is minus, you know, minus 1.07, you might just say, well, those are just random numbers. But if they do sort of come out to these with a very high precision to some to some, you know, interesting number, then I think that also begs the question, or rather we have the answer to a question that we probably don't know what is quite yet. So coming to my conclusions, so the first thing is that, yeah, we are looking for CP violation, but we really need to understand it if and when we observe it. And so the good news is that T to K with JPARC, the accelerated beam, we're in a position to make some decisive developments in studying neutrino CP violation. So we're going to have an upgrade to a megawatt class beam, which will allow us to take data much faster, and also to upgrade a super K detector to hyper K, which will also be give us an impressive gain. And so the nice thing about this is that it's sort of continuous. So it's not like, you know, you wait 15 years and then you start taking data, but rather because this is a stage program, we can get started with the beam upgrades and get our first initial shot at CP violation in what we're calling TDK phase two. And then hopefully during that time, we'll also build hyper K and we can follow up on whatever we see or not see here with a much more capable and sensitive detector. Okay. Thank you very much. It's actually about the same. So we have TDK in its initial phase running to around 2021. That's about the same scale as NOVA. They're anticipating a six-year run, three years in antineutrinos, 3 years in antineutrinos. This started in 2014 with some ramp up in beam power. And yeah, that takes it to 2020, 2021. So my hope is that they will, all right, so there's that. And so formally, that program is supposed to end in 2021. Experiments like Dune are expected to start beam operations around 2026. And so my hope is that Fermilab will do the same thing and continue to run NOVA until Dune actually starts. It's a bit more complicated for them because, right, the NOVA beam line and the LBNF beam line are different. And so while they are operating this NOVA beam line, they have to construct the LBNF beam line, whereas in TDK we have one beam line that's sort of being upgraded. And so, yeah.
It's a different direction.
Right? Yeah, it's a different direction, yeah. Yeah, one's this way and one's that way, yeah. And they're just different. So, and this is if you remember NOVA, the NOVA beam line was actually built for Minos. And so most of those things are rated for 700 kilowatt beam power. Whereas Dune, you know, has ambitions to get to 1.2 and then 2.4 megawatts. And so that beam line just doesn't work with those power. Fortunately for T to K, there was some foresight which said that basically all the irreducible components of the beam line should have multi-megawatt capability. So things which are going to get radioactive, highly radioactive, like the beam dump, the decay region walls, which cannot be replaced, are already capable of 2 to 4 megawatts. And what the beam line upgrades are concerned with are mainly improving the cooling of the system so that it can handle the additional heat load from the extra beam. And so that's an interesting story because apparently when T2K faced some kind of budget constraints, the director at KEK told them to basically get rid of that megawatt capability. And I think they just ignored it. And they did it anyways. Yeah.
So about baryogenesis. So what's the significance of the actual value of the CP? So is it just that you have CP violation or not? Or
right. Yeah. So this is on the experimental side, there's the challenge of actually establishing CP violation and measuring the value of delta CP. I think there's a equally challenging issue of how you connect that to the issue of baryogenesis and the primordial matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe. In the standard picture, right, there's a sort of the standard leptogenesis picture, there's a real struggle between connecting some kind of light CP odd phase that we see in the light neutrinos with these heavy Majorana particles, which supposedly induce the leptogenesis. The one thing I have seen is, there are some papers which show that the Yaws-Clog invariant associated with the neutrino mixing, if that's large enough, you know, so that involves sine delta plus all these mixing angles. If that's large enough, then in principle, there's enough CP violation present within the light neutrinos itself to induce the asymmetry. So that's sort of an interesting bound. But beyond that, I don't know that there's much more that people have been able to say. You know, people are saying that if you look at the mathematical picture, right? You basically have this system of heavy Majorana Dirac phases. They undergo mixing in the seesaw mechanism, and so there is some fundamental matrix that starts off with. You start off with, and then, and basically those parameters get split across the light neutrinos and the heavy neutrinos, and so they are connected. But as far as what those connections are, you know, it's I think is exactly the same as trying to predict. Well, we have no idea where these things come from, so even when they're just sitting in the same matrix. So.
Bit of a far-field question, but one of the things that NOAA was going to do that was new and cool was they're going to use these scintillating detectors to actually provide some discrimination between neutral current events and electron neutrino events. Do you know whether they were successful?
Yeah. So one of the big things that they did recently, I don't know, do I have a picture of a? Oh no, I didn't put in the picture of an electron neutrino. Okay. So I think what you're pointing to is that when you have a tracking detector like this, if you see, if this is an electron neutrino, then that electron comes directly out of the vertex, whereas a photon may, from a pi zero event, will travel some distance before showering and producing an electromagnetic shower. It's been a little bit difficult for me to ascertain how they're actually using that information, because all their information, well, in their first analysis, I think it went through, they would do, well, there are two methods. They had this library event matching, right, where basically you generate all these Monte Carlo representations of your signal and Monte Carlo representations of your background, and then basically you're trying to do a matching between these two things and find which category is most likely. So they're definitely using the, to the extent that your simulated events would have that gap if it's a background, not have that gap if it's a signal. They're definitely using that information in the library event matching. Now, recently, they've actually started to use convolutional neural networks in analyzing not the muon neutrinos, but the electron neutrinos. And so there, it's a little bit, well, it's not really clear to me exactly where they find the, where they would make use of that information, but apparently they are. So based on that, they were able to achieve something like a 30% increase in efficiency without increasing the background rate while maintaining the purity. So yeah, I would say that they've been quite successful generally in this electron neutrino to neutral current separation, and especially recently. So we also had a sort of a big development here as well. And so in our case, it used to be that this background was primarily neutral current, but then we also had algorithm improvements that we put in about 3 years ago that reduced it by a factor of three. And so now the
pi zero is created by neutral current?
Yeah.
Sorry, is your pi zero reconstruction got better?
Yeah. And so now that's not even the dominant background anymore. The dominant background now is primarily electron neutrinos, which are present in the beam, even in the absence of oscillations. And so in some sense, we reached a limit because all the backgrounds which are in principle rejectable are already at a level which is significantly lower than the irreducible background from actual electron neutrinos in our detector.
The remaining electron neutrino events you're not rejecting are certainly distinguishable from
No, I'm saying that the background is actually electron neutrinos.
Oh, it is actually.
They're actually electron neutrinos, and so yeah, if you somehow you were able to reject those, then you're Yeah, it's interesting. I like to make that point because when I was very young, when we were planning these next generation of experiments, people were saying, especially collider people were saying, are these next generation of experiments going to use the same miserable technology with water or scintillator or whatever? And there's also been a lot made of tracking detectors and also liquid argon, but as of right now, this new generation of experiments are still working on their reconstruction and actually have not reached a level of performance that we achieve with water current golf right now. So.
So would any of this fancy technology like water-based liquid scintillators would it help in any way with the CPU errors?
For CP violation, I'm a little bit skeptical in terms of actual sort of pattern recognition and background rejection, because we're already doing very well. One area where it could help is with the energy reconstruction. If we have more precise energy reconstruction, we can measure the neutrino energy better, and then we can, you know, map this oscillation pattern better. Probably the most dramatic aspect of water-based liquid scintillator is actually in proton decay, in particular the K-plus mode, where in water Cherenkov, the K-plus is initially invisible because of sub-Cherenkov, and then we only see the subsequent muon or, you know, whatever particles come out of that. And so by having some scintillation, you will get an extra hold on that initial phase of the proton decay where the K-plus is produced, and then the additional signatures from the muons or the pions, which also come out.
More questions? Okay, let's thank you.
Thank you.